Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I'll say only this to set things up today, gang. CNBC is running a countdown clock to the government shutdown. So, yeah, we've come to that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 20th of September. Good as always to have you with us. 10 short days on that CNBC countdown clock. That's how long Congress has to decide whether or not it wants to shut down the government. The version of a funding bill the House passed today along party lines is the one that strips money from Obamacare, which means it's going nowhere with the president. And that is just the next 10 days. Sometime long about the middle of October, we're going to do the debt limit dance again. So, with apologies to Yogi Berra, yeah, it's that deja vu all over again thing. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark gets us going.
Once upon a time in the spring of 2011, we were on the brink of a government shutdown. It didn't happen. Then a few months later, we came dangerously close to defaulting on our nation's debt. That didn't happen either. Since then, we've had more scares, government shutdowns, the fiscal cliff. It's enough drama to want to hand Congress a cup of warm milk and read them a bedtime story. I don't know, maybe
the boy who cried wolf.
You know, the one where the boy keeps going,
wolf, wolf. Hurry! Come quickly!
We hope this is the boy who cried wolf, because in that story, basically, it didn't happen.
Daryl West directs governance studies at the Brookings Institution. He says the reason these threats of government shutdowns and debt defaults keep being sounded in the last few years goes back to 2011, when a lot of Republicans were voted into Congress by folks who felt the government was spending much too much. West says they've used threats to show how serious they are and then talk themselves off the cliff at the last minute. The fear this time
is whether House Republicans are so upset about government spending that they are literally willing to walk to the top of that cliff and jump off.
That's something that Josh Green, who covers politics for Business Week, is actually kind of rooting for.
At a certain point, you have to kind of lance the boil and demonstrate to everybody, who's going to pay the price if the government does shut down.
Green says a temporary government shutdown would be disruptive, but probably not do long-term damage. Defaulting on the debt limit, however, that's the stuff of nightmares, wolves, cliffs, and all. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
So much to talk about, so little time, but you can squeeze a lot into 4 minutes of live radio. Felix Salmon from Reuters and Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine are at Marketplace East, our studios in New York, to talk about the week that was. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Salmon. Whatever that was. So Felix, you get the first question just because you gave me a snooty hello. Were you surprised at all that the Federal Reserve decided not to begin its taper, the backing off of quantitative easing this week?
I had talked myself out of this idea. I thought that they wouldn't. When the last jobs report came out and it was bad, I thought to myself, they're not going to taper. And then all of Wall Street started pricing in a taper, and everyone expected a taper. And the Federal Reserve is normally quite good at guiding market expectations. So I assumed that the market had read the tea leaves more expertly than I had and that they knew what they were talking about. So by the time the day came, I was expecting this taper to happen. And so, yes, I was surprised.
Lee, were you surprised? And part two of the question is, do you think the Fed, having telegraphed so clearly that it was going to taper this week, has lost credibility by not?
You know, I don't think so. I was sort of surprised, and I know that's not a fun answer, but
that's all right.
I think what's happening is first we became addicted to the stimulus, and then we became addicted to the communication about the stimulus. So when the slightest part of that kind of falls apart, and when the communication starts to get a little vaguer, which it has over the past couple months, people don't know what to make of it. And so whose fault is it if the forward guidance is misunderstood? I mean, it's kind of a chain. So I don't think that Bernanke is as to blame as some people.
All right. So do they punt now, Felix, and just leave it for Janet Yellen or whoever takes over come January?
That would seem that's my guess. Yes. It seems a bit weird for them to not taper in September and then suddenly turn around in October and say, well, nothing's really changed, but we're going to start doing it now. The Bernanke's tenure is coming to an end. Yeah. And this is, I guess, the job of his successor right now.
Quickly, before we move on to Washington and whatever's going on down there, any dissenters from the view that it's going to be Janet Yellen, either of you two? Okay,
no.
You're saying
it's going to be Janet Yellen.
As a yes. All right. So, Lee, moving on to Washington, you know, Chrissy was telling us about how we've been there before. Is this time any different with the debt limit and all of the things that are happening this coming month?
I don't think it's different. I think it's the same basic plot line. I think we'll push it right to the brink, and I think mm-hmm. that rationality will step in at the 11th hour.
Why do you believe that rationality will step in?
I mean, what makes you believe that the Congress is rational?
Because it always does. Nobody wants the economy to crumble, and that's what would happen. And, I mean, we've seen this happen time and time again. It's the same childish pedantic behavior.
Felix, get to the is it different this time thing. Are the stakes higher? Is there more at risk? Are people getting sick and tired of it? I mean, you know, the market, as we know, the market hates uncertainty. And how much more uncertain can you get?
But then again, when there's uncertainty, you get a flight to quality, and that brings yields down, and that makes the market happy. Whole thing is very hard to parse. It's like those stupid wars between the television carriers and the cable stations. And, you know, they wind up going off the air and then people get upset and then they come back on the air. Government shutdown is a bit like that. Debt ceiling is frankly a bit like that as well. So long as we don't actually default on our bonds, and frankly we're not going to do that, we'll do virtually anything before doing that.
People keep saying that, but how does the market know? How can the market trust us? Yeah, uh-huh. See?
Well, I worry less in this case about the market than what a government shutdown would do for, or a default on the debt ceiling would do to everyday Americans who would lose their jobs and who have not benefited at all from this. Well, not at all, but they haven't benefited nearly as much as investors from this, what the stock market has done.
All right, we got to go. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Felix Salmon from Reuters. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, see you. Have a good weekend. Traders did not like what they were seeing today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. There was a moment truly made for radio at the Environmental Protection Agency today. Administrator Gina McCarthy was announcing the Obama administration's new rules for carbon emissions from new coal and gas power plants. Carbon from Gina McCarthy, a proud Bostonian.
I should make sure that everybody knows when I say carbon, it's C-A-R-B-O-N. Because everybody sometimes looks at me and goes, what? I'll talk about cars later, too, which is C-A-R.
Accents aside, the news is big. For the first time, the government is setting limits for the greenhouse gases that come out of new power plants. Coal-fired plants would take the biggest hit. But Marketplace's Sarah Gardner explains those mysterious market forces are already at work.
Before Gina McCarthy even uttered the words carbon limits today, the coal industry was declaring a war on coal and speed-dialing litigators. That's because those limits are so strict, they force the industry to build a whole new kind of coal plant, one that captures CO2 and buries it as well. Dan Lashoff at the Natural Resources Defense Council.
The coal industry has been touting for years that it has clean coal technology, and this rule says, well, if you got it, you got to use it.
But it's so pricey, the industry complains, nobody will build another coal plant in the U.S. ever. Energy consultant Richard Morse says whether the EPA intends that or not, it doesn't matter. The marketplace has spoken.
The U.S. coal market over the last few years has really been transformed by developments in the natural gas market.
Coal's upstart rival, cheap and abundant natural gas. That's why no one's planning new coal plants right now. In fact, the feds are predicting that in 20 years, the vast majority of new power will come from this comparatively cleaner fossil fuel. So if utilities are switching over anyway, why the fuss?
Well, this is a prelude to a much more important rule, which will deal with existing coal-fired power plants.
David Victor at the University of California, San Diego, says if the EPA cracks down hard on those plants, expect a wave of coal plant closings. And it's those plants and future ones that utilities see as their safety net just in case natural gas prices were to double or triple in the future. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Most people still watch TV on actual TVs, but small screens, tablets, and smartphones are picking up, especially among younger viewers. The thing is, those smaller screens aren't being counted. At least, they're not being counted by Nielsen, the people that do the all-important Nielsen ratings used by networks to set the all-important ad rates. Broadcasters have been howling for years that Nielsen's old-fashioned ways are costing them a fortune. Next fall, though, as in 2014, they may get some relief. Nielsen said today it's going to start counting some mobile viewers. Marketplace's Noel King has that story.
ABC's Scandal is a monster hit.
I am in love with a woman who is not my wife.
America's biggest obsession is back.
If last season is any indication, around 9 million people are going to tune in when the show comes back in October. A lot more are going to watch on their cell phones and tablets, but Nielsen won't be counting them.
Nielsen has long been the Neanderthal of online ratings. Their ability to rate consumption of online video on desktop and mobile and tablet has been slow, sluggish, and almost non-existent.
Bernard Gershon is president of a digital media strategy firm. He says Nielsen's created a problem for networks. If the number of people watching their shows is artificially low, they're leaving advertising dollars on the table. And that could be big money, says Tom Adams of IHS Global Insight, because the viewers who are watching on their mobile devices,
they're binging on Breaking Bad and Mad Men,
are young people, the demographic that advertisers are willing to pay the most to capture. But analysts like Bernard Gershon say Nielsen's move to start tracking mobile viewers is only a small step forward.
Nielsen is not rating programs that are on Netflix or Amazon Prime or non-network programs that are on Hulu.
He says until viewers on those platforms are counted, the picture of who is watching what and where won't be complete. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
We're going to take the German elections this weekend. Angela Merkel is expected to win, by the way. We're going to take those elections and turn them on their head a little bit. For the last of our series on Europe's biggest economy, we're going to focus on something that is, on the face of it, a purely religious matter, the Protestant Reformation. But as Germany gears up to celebrate the 500th anniversary of the birth of Protestantism, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports on the economic legacy of the split with Rome. And he went to the source to do it, too, the small German town of Wittenberg, where the Reformation began.
A door may seem an odd tourist attraction, but it was on this church door at Wittenberg's castle in 1517 that Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses and launched the Reformation. Well, this was not the actual door.
The door that you see there is a memorial door from the 19th century. So you see, it's bronze. Even Luther would have a hard time nailing something onto that bronze door.
The old wooden one burned down in 1760, but no matter. Astrid Mühlmann and her colleagues in the German government are pinning their hopes of a tourism bonanza on this door.
We're expecting millions of people to come.
Millions, really?
You really think that Martin Luther and his 95 theses will attract millions of visitors?
That's what we're working on.
In the run-up to the anniversary, the government is pouring $7 million a year into renovating the church and other Reformation-related sites. This isn't just about tourism. This is a chance for Germany to celebrate its past for a change. And, says economist Gustav Horn, to mark the birth of Protestantism and its world-famous work ethic.
Protestants perceive work as a kind of Berufung, as we say in Germany, which is a kind of devotion to please God.
A form of worship.
A form of worship, yes. This is certainly something that is deep within the German soul, the Protestant soul at least.
Protestantism, according to Harvard historian Niall Ferguson, was one of the reasons the West pulled ahead of the rest of the world, because it made a religion out of hard work and making money. And with its emphasis on scripture, it spread literacy. But Gustav Horn says Germany's Protestant faith may have also left the country with its deep aversion to debt, not always a good thing.
The German word for debt, Schuld, is also the same word as a moral failure. So the connotation is quite clear. If you have a high debt burden, you have morally failed.
Yes, it's our old friend Protestant guilt. It's a truism, but it certainly exists in Germany today, says Leslie Spiecher. An American teacher, she settled in Wittenberg 14 years ago and has found herself becoming ever more anxious, ever more German.
I take things more seriously. I plan.
You save.
I save, absolutely. I have insurance for everything from broken fingernails to broken glass.
There's one school of thought that says here lies the only ultimate solution to the Eurozone crisis. Germany needs another cultural shift, like the Reformation. To end the imbalances, the country should loosen up, stop saving, and spend.
Sounds good.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah, sounds like fun.
But judging by Bettina Brett, a guide in the Luther Museum, it's not going to happen.
You have to pay for the fun. You know, I can say, well, I would like to have a little bit more fun. I would like to go on a very long vacation. If I find someone who pays for it, it's absolutely German. We are more careful.
A second Reformation doesn't seem to be on its way. In Wittenberg, Germany, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The honey had been adulterated with residues of antibiotics that are banned in the U.S.
Dirty honey, people. Really. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, here you go. The Dow Industrials gave up 185 points today, 1.2%, 15,451 at the bell for the blue chips. The NASDAQ dropped 14 points, 0.4%, finished at 3774. The S&P 500 down 12 points, 0.7%. Ended at 1709. For the week, the Dow gained 0.6%. The NASDAQ up 1.3%. The S&P 500 gained 1.4%. BlackBerry was the big loser. It announced it's going to report a nearly $1 billion loss and is laying off 40% of its workforce. Shares off 16% today. Coal companies sank with the EPA news on Cobb and Walter Energy off 8%. Alpha Natural Resources 6% lower. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday. Vice President Biden is scheduled to travel to Colorado to survey flood damage and recovery efforts. Start planning your sweater wardrobe. Monday is already the second day of fall. And Neptune was discovered on September 23, 1846. A year on Neptune is 60,190 days. Makes you feel so young, doesn't it? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. When you think of things being smuggled from China through Asia and landing at American ports of call, lots of things come to mind. Drugs, possibly. Counterfeit electronics, perhaps. But honey? Yeah, it's true. Susan Burfield writes in the current issue of Bloomberg Businessweek about a German food company named ALW that pretty much cornered the market on dirty honey, at least until it got caught. Susan, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Honey smuggling is not something I'd ever thought of.
You know, this is the biggest case of food fraud in U.S. history, and it is about Chinese honey that was smuggled into the U.S. to avoid very high tariffs and made its way into our food chain.
Give me a sense of proportion here, would you? You write that we consume in this country some amazing, first of all, more honey than any other country in the world, right?
That's right. 400 million pounds of honey a year. A lot of that is imported, and about half of it goes into the food system, meaning food companies use it in cereals, bread, other kinds of processed food. So it's not necessarily the honey on the table. Mm-hmm. And much of the honey that was smuggled in by this German company was sold to U.S. food companies.
And they even, what did they do? They filtered out the pollen, right, so that we wouldn't be able to sort of backtrack it, I guess?
That's right. So you can use pollen to identify the country where the honey has been produced. They also sometimes would dilute the honey with molasses or other things to kind of cover up the bad taste that some Chinese honey had. And then in a few cases, the honey had been adulterated with residues of antibiotics that are banned in the U.S. And that was to fight off a disease that some of the Chinese bee colonies were facing at the time.
How did the FDA happen upon, or the feds anyway, happen upon this whole operation? I mean, why did it take them so long to figure it out?
There's very little inspection that goes on in the ports and other places where food comes in. You know, the government doesn't have the resources to monitor that. The U.S. is the world's biggest food importer. They do have to rely on tips. And in this case, it was the U.S. honey producers who tipped them off and said, we've seen this honey being sold. We know it's sold by this company. You should look into it. And they began investigating. And, you know, as one of the agents said, you know, they really had no idea in the beginning how big this would be. They pursued this case beginning in 2008. And the investigation, they say, continues today.
Give me a dollar value for how much, you know, the smuggled honey industry is worth. Do you know?
Worldwide, the counterfeit food industry is about $49 billion. This one company evaded taxes that were probably worth about $260 million. So somewhere between that and $49 billion.
So not small, right? I mean, you know.
You know, significant, and, you know, even more significant for, I think, for what it suggests. Honey is one ingredient. We know there's, you know, been cases of diluted olive oil, other things that aren't health threats, but suggest that there are openings and vulnerabilities that are very, very hard to keep track of.
The piece is in Bloomberg Businessweek. It's called Dirty Honey, Uncovering the Largest Food Fraud in U.S. History. Susan Burfield wrote it. Susan, thanks a bunch.
Thank you very much.
The state of Louisiana has tried to get people to wear it and hunt it, even serve it at fancy restaurants. Now they want your dog to eat it. It here is Nutria. Thing looks like a giant rat, apparently. The 12-pound or so invasive mammal species damages thousands of acres of coastal wetlands every single year, so you can understand the search for market-based solutions. Except the trappers who catch them are a dying breed, as Sam Harnett reports.
Robert Raymond is retired, but he can't stop working. Trapping is in his blood.
I'm Robert Raymond. I live in Lacombe, Louisiana. I'm 60 years old. I've been trapping my whole life. It's all I've ever done is trap nutrias, mink, muskrat, otters, coons, bobcat, and alligators. And I've made a successful living doing it. And I'm one of the last people in the state that does it.
Louisiana needs trappers like Raymond. Their expertise helps keep the nutria population from spiraling out of control.
You find a nutria trail where he travels every night, and you set the trap in a trail just like this. And this is how he just steps in it just like so. And that's it. It catches him about a foot, either front foot or back foot.
Raymond is one of 100 people who bring in a lion's share of the coastal nutria caught each year.
It's kind of a lifestyle of a lot of the coastal people. And a lot of that has since gone by the wayside.
Edmund Moten directs the Nutria Control Program for the Louisiana Department of Fish and Wildlife. He says trapping was once standard work in the winter for crabbers, shrimpers, and fishermen. The fur market peaked in the 1970s.
The average price in the mid-1970s was $9, and they were harvesting over 2 million nutria alone during that time frame.
He says back then there were around 15,000 trappers. Today, there are 2,000, and the price of nutria fur is about $2. In 2002, the state started offering a $5 bounty. They hoped it would keep the population down and the trapping tradition alive.
The idea behind the program was to create an artificial inflated price with an incentive program to emulate a good fur market.
It's been pretty successful, bringing in around 320,000 nutria a year. But it costs almost $3 million annually in state and federal funds. To try and create a new natural demand, Louisiana has promoted nutria as eco-friendly fur and a culinary delicacy. Apparently, it tastes like rabbit. Well, neither concept has taken off, perhaps because of the nutria's association with rats or those front teeth it has, like giant tobacco-stained daggers. Anyway, that brings us to the dogs.
Maybe it's the wild taste of it, but they absolutely go crazy over it.
Vennie Harlan and her brother Hansel have a new business plan for Nutria. Protein-rich, allergen-free, locally sourced, and very eco-conscious dog treats. Their company is called Marsh Dog.
We take 1 whole pound of Nutria to create an eco-sustainable, healthy, totally tasty treat. It's good for your dog and great for coastal wetlands.
Hansel says they aim to create a market that'll encourage people to trap more Nutria.
It's sort of harnessing the forces of capitalism in order to address a larger good.
Achieving that larger good means eradicating Nutria, which puts them in a funny position as a business.
Well, our goal would be to be put out of business.
With several million Nutria in the state, they won't be disappearing anytime soon, especially if trappers like Raymond really start retiring. In Lacombe, Louisiana, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which comes with a reminder that iOS 7 is upon us. iPads and iPhones the world over are being updated with the new operating system. And I can tell you firsthand, it's quite a change, both for grown-ups, of course, also the children who use their parents' gadgets, including, I kid you not, this 4-year-old whose dad apparently updated yesterday.
What's different?
Everything.
Well, you're just going to have to get used to it.
No, I don't want it.
Great, right? I mean, you feel bad for the kid, but oh, man. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday. Sometimes you just want to cry, right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.